Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Hi, welcome back. I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. NAD is everywhere right now, literally all the rage. But most people are only hearing half the story, and I think we all need to hear the full story. This is important. Today, I'm sitting down with Courtney von Busum to break down the real cellular science, from the salvage pathways to inflammation, stress, and the hidden factors accelerating energy decline. Whether you're using NAD precursors, NAD IVs, sub-Q NAD, transdermal NAD, this episode adds the nuance you didn't even know you needed. And I'm telling you guys, we all need it. So there are going to be some special offers for you about a couple of the products we talk about in the episode. If you're interested, they will be in the show notes. But again, you know what? I'm going to keep saying this before the podcast. Before you go shopping, please check out the episode, learn about the topic, and then see if this is something that you need to pay attention to. Next up, we're going to thank a couple of our sponsors who make the podcast possible, and then we're diving in. I want to talk about strength, not just lifting heavier, but feeling capable in your body. For many women, especially in perimenopause and beyond, we tend to notice fatigue first. Workouts might feel harder, recovery takes longer, and mental sharpness starts to decline. One of the most important supplements a woman over 40 can take may surprise you. It's your creatine. Our bodies make it, but we make less with age. While creatine is often marketed to men, women actually experience the steepest decline after 40. And creatine is essential for brain health, focus, and cellular energy. That's why I love Qualia Creatine Plus. It uses two clinically tested, highly bioavailable forms of creatine, plus magnesium and electrolytes to help to support lean muscle, energy, and mental clarity. If you want to feel stronger, sharper, and more resilient, this is a foundational supplement. Qualia's creatine is my recommendation because creatine is too important to get wrong. If you want to give it a try, all you have to do is go to qualialife.com/Natalie and use code Natalie. That's N-A-T-H-A-L-I-E. Don't forget about the H, to save up to 50% plus get an additional 15% off. That's Qualia Creatine Plus at qualialife.com/Natalie.
Most people think detox means suffering, but the truth is your body already knows how to detox. All it needs is the support. When your liver is overloaded from alcohol, from sugar, from inflammatory foods, it stays stuck in survival mode instead of performance mode. This is where Complete Liver Complex by Level Up Health comes in. Introduce this supplement so that you can support your liver's natural detox pathways. No fasting marathons, no weird teas, and no white knuckling. This formula supports hormone clearance, blood sugar regulation, cholesterol metabolism, and fat processing. All the things that tend to get a little, you know, kind of stuck. And a supported liver means better energy, clearer skin, and a body that feels ready for what's next. January isn't about pushing harder. It's about clearing what's holding you back. I love this liver complex, you guys. I do 30 days every few months every year, and it never fails to deliver. So to get your hands on your own, go to leveluphealth.com, LVLuphealth.com, and make sure to use code NAT to save 20% off your order. Courtney von Busum, welcome to the show. It is a pleasure to finally have you here today.
Yeah. Hi, Nat. Thank you for having me. Super excited to join and talk cellular pathways and all things NAD and beyond.
NAD. Very controversial topic these days and very hot. But before we dive into the science and all the things, I want to talk a little bit about you, because you've kind of come onto the scene over the last, what is it, last couple of years, really, right? But you grew up in a family that is all about this stuff. You grew up surrounded by healthcare and this really interesting combination of healthcare and entrepreneurship. So What's the earliest memory you have of that world, kind of that inkling of you thinking, oh, maybe I'm going to go into this myself?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually haven't. No one's fully asked me the origin story. As you alluded to, my mom's a doctor in this space, and she got into longevity medicine 20 years ago and started a clinic with my dad. So the entrepreneurship and medical blend, and I sat right into the middle of that. But I knew I never wanted to be a doctor because I watched that and I didn't want anything to do with that. But I liked science. So that's where I studied biomedical engineering. And that was my baseline for it. But then kind of got into the business side of it and studied a lot of entrepreneurship, startups, worked with startups, joined startups. And then I did something completely different. I worked marketing at FinTech for a little while as like my coming of age job.
Nice. Nice.
But I think I love it. It really did, you know, as you alluded to, it really seeped into my subconscious in a lot of ways. You know, I remember like in high school, my mom telling me about the dangers of birth control pills, right? And at that time, everyone I knew was getting on birth control pills, and that's what you did. And I share this story in jest, even though it's kind of psychotic, but when I somehow, you know, as a mother does, she found out, like, I was thinking about trying to get on birth control, and she printed out a bunch of research studies and put them on my bed.
I know your mother, and I can see that. What did you do, just leave it on your pillow?
Yeah, I was like, what do I do with this? But I was scared enough that I didn't follow through at that time. So I think, you know, it's kind of always been something I knew, and it was really crazy to try to live in that world, but have traditional medicine being talked about all around me. And then now in the last, so I did something else for a while, and then COVID brought me back to Colorado. And that's really when I started to get involved more deeply in longevity business and working with Longevity Clinic. And so then we started the second company, Longevity Launch Labs, as the way to do the business side of what we had learned. Nice. So it was a nice pairing to really get my feet in the operations, but then also start to build some of these broader business initiatives.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's interesting how as a comparatively young person, you've kind of jumped into this longevity space. Like when people ask me, why'd you go into longevity? I'm like, well, dude, I'm old. Of course I'm going to get into longevity. But, you know, young people are notorious. More youthful people are notorious for never believing they're going to get old. And I feel like there's a new awareness around longevity that people need to start young. For best results, you want to start as young as possible to thinking and orienting yourself in this space.
I grew up around trying to understand preventative medicine, even when you're being told you don't need, you know, you're young, you're fine. But everyone now says, yeah, I mean, prevention starts when you're healthy, right? So I kind of luckily started to build a lot of those mindsets early. So it's been fun to watch like my friends and people starting now just to hit their 30s and their 40s, asking me all these questions that I've been talking about for a long time.
What really pushed you towards solving age-related problems instead of something else? Like when did, you know, like you clearly made a decision because, and we're going to talk about some of the, you know, some of the molecules, some of the pathways that you dove into and came out the other side with new solutions to. When was that? Was there an inflection point?
I mean, it's a little cliche, but I think COVID was that. It forced me home, and it forced me back into this mindset of health much more deeply. And, you know, at that time, right, we're starting to learn about cellular pathways that I'd already kind of been hearing about. So a lot of my history of biomedical engineering and learning biology and chemistry and all of this actually being talked about in the mainstream. And then I got involved in the clinic, started to do operations, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I really like this blend of the science and the operations, and I'm really good at it. So I sort of started to go down that path. So I don't know if it was so much like I was like, this is now my future, but it was, I started to see that there was this need and my skill set really matched it.
You know, it's funny how the world has now oriented to before COVID and after COVID. It's pretty wild. And do you think that COVID changed? Like, I feel like COVID was a bit of it's a blip, and it changed our trajectory in many ways from a health perspective. Like, we now have to take that the presence of what's got left behind. And we have to take it into account in almost everything that we do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little scary, but I think, and what, you know, if you take a more optimistic mindset, I think we will propel things forward way faster than we would have otherwise, because to exactly that, I mean, a post-COVID world is real. We see way more, you know, health problems as a result of the spike protein, COVID vaccine, all of it. I was just talking to somebody at A4M who's working on that, and they were saying, you know, even if you got COVID once, they can still test for the spike protein in your blood, right? Mm-hmm. It's still causing mayhem. So we have to figure out, you know, how to
mitigate it.
Yeah. What to do.
Yeah. We're seeing, what do we do about it?
Yeah. And that's where, like, being in the clinic, I saw those patients, right? We were one of the first clinics that kind of got known as a long COVID clinic, just because we looked at cellular pathways, and that's what happens. COVID kills your mitochondria. And so how do you heal that? So
yeah,
it's a post-COVID world, and we have to learn to live in it.
For sure. And it is interesting. I mean, this off topic for our podcast today, but it is interesting to me how understanding the people who have the obvious lasting effects and yet other people were not, which in and of itself will force us,
right,
as well, force the medical industry to really start to consider what leaves one person susceptible and another one more resilient. And it doesn't mean the resilient person doesn't still have maybe some built in weaknesses that they didn't have before, but to your point, I think it's going to push us. It's going to push the medical industry to really take a harder look at these things.
I think it also pushes us, you know, we've talked about preventative medicine a lot. I think now I'm going to coin this term, but like resilient medicine, because resilience is the great word, right? How do you build resilience? Because everything is a toxic world. Everything is trying to hurt your ability to heal and survive. So how do you be resilient against that?
Looking back, what did you once believe about aging or metabolic health that you now realize was completely wrong? Or what have you changed your mind on? Is there anything?
Yeah, I think, you know, fundamentally, I think what I would have to say, the thing that I changed my mind most on, especially as I've gotten deeper into cellular medicine, is that we just need to support our cells and our systems in the way that they were already designed. I think a lot of like longevity and biohacking has been, how do we fix this? How do we, you know, force us in a certain direction, improve this thing, and by taking a bunch of net new. And the more you look at how intuitive our cells are and our systems are, you learn, actually, let me just nudge and let me just heal, and then things will work naturally. So I think a lot of times we cause more problems by trying to, you know, throw everything in the kitchen sink at fixing it, versus maybe we could be a little more intelligent in this little tiny steps that we take.
Yeah, I think that that's a perfect segue into our conversation, because NAD is at the center of this, people thinking if some is good, more is better. And how do I push this? And how do I optimize my NAD? How do I get more NAD? So for people who know they've heard about NAD, but they don't really understand the biochemistry. First of all, why should every longevity enthusiast really care about NAD in any way?
Yeah. So, I mean, NAD has gotten kind of some hype for a good reason, right? NAD is found in every single one of our cells. So therefore, that tells us it's pretty fundamental to how life works and life functions. And so just to define it, you know, NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, but we just know it as NAD. And it's a coenzyme. And so what that means is that it's actually this molecule that allows our enzymes to function and to catalyze different processes of life. And what's so powerful about NAD, and why I do say it's kind of worth the hype, is that it's this really interesting redox molecule. And redox, if we remember from way back in, you know, early bio, is the ability to go from reduction and oxidation. And this is this flipping back and forth that causes energy to move along the electron transport chain. And that's what creates ATP, right? And so NAD is actually the category for NADH and NAD plus. So it's two sides of the same coin. And that's important because that NAD plus, right, is the oxidized form, and it means it's missing an electron. So it has this positive charge that allows electron transport to then happen. And that is what that movement of electrons is critical to how our cells make ATP, which is how our cells make energy to do literally everything. So that's why you should care about NAD. And I think that we've started to understand it has this really important role in cellular energy, but also in cellular repair. That part doesn't get talked about as much, that you need NAD to repair, you know, your DNA through your PARPs, and your sirtuins need it. And so it's this really critical energy molecule that your system relies on for functioning.
That's a great explanation. And I love that you bring up NADH, because I think it's the other half that never, that really doesn't get talked about. And I think that where we get in trouble is by ignoring the NADH piece, we lack understanding and balance in the fact that there needs to be balance between NAD and NADH. And the cell is desperate to hang on to that balance. And I think that might be where there may be trouble brewing, in this obsession for bringing more NAD into the system.
100%. I mean, they're, like I said, they're two sides of the same coin, and that ratio is really important. And that ratio actually is different in the serum than it is in the cytoplasm, than it is inside the mitochondria. So our cells have different levels of NAD plus and NADH. And that's why just this idea of, like, let me measure my NAD plus levels in the serum is kind of useless in a lot of ways, because it's not giving you that inside scoop of what's the balance. And NAD is super critical. Like you said, it's kind of that first molecule that helps, you know, start electron transport and kind of kicking those electrons down and helping the, I like this analogy that Chat gave me that I've been using a lot, which is like ATP is the money that the body spends and NAD is the banking system. Right? So you're cashing in NAD and NADH, and that's what allows your body to use the cash of your glucose and your ketones and your fuel sources.
That's a good analogy. I love a good analogy. I love a good analogy. And that's something that people can really understand, right? So let's talk about what happens to NAD as we age. So a lot of people talk about NAD just naturally goes down as we age, which means we have less cellular energy. And to your point, less cellular energy means nothing works as well as it should, whether it's repair of DNA, whether it's metabolizing the nutrients that you eat, like nothing in the body is going to happen if it doesn't have the energy, if the cells don't have the energy that they need. So, but from your scientific and engineering perspective, and I have to say that I love engineers in this space because people, the engineers in this space, and sometimes they have almost no medical background, but there's such a systems mindset that they're able to break everything down. And they always, when I was coaching, they were the best clients because everything was on a spreadsheet. Everything, you know, so I could go through the spreadsheet and say, okay, get rid of this, 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 this. We're going to add that, you know, like it just, I love the engineering mindset. If I come back, I want to be an engineer. But going back to the question, from your scientific and engineering perspective, why is that an oversimplification? What's actually happening in the cells when we see that NAD decline?
Yeah. Well, quickly, I appreciate the engineering mindset call it because I like genuinely enjoy talking cellular pathways. And I think probably that's weird for most people, not in our space as much, but it's because it makes sense to an engineer. Like it's actually like very stepwise.
Right.
So to lead into that, so NAD fits into that. And it's kind of why I've gotten to know these pathways so well. But this idea that we make less NAD as we age is very much a misconception. We definitely, you know, when you look at the NAD available to us as we age, that number may be less. And I think that's where this idea has come from. And it's really not because our cells forgot how to make NAD. We have this really smart system of NAD recycling, right, called the salvage pathway. But it's that we have more things consuming and degrading our NAD. And that's kind of the crux of the misconception. So we think, oh, okay, I have less NAD. I need to pour more in. And we use this bucket analogy a lot, right? Here's my bucket of NAD. It's less. Let me fill it up. But we've totally forgotten to plug all the holes in the bottom of the bucket, which are the degradative enzymes and the things that are eating and consuming your NAD. And what are those things? Well, as we get older, there's more of these drainage inflammatory drainage systems, right? And so that could be stress, that could be inflammation, that could be illness. But there's these enzymes, like one of them is called CD38, one's called NNMT. We can talk about those a little bit more. But they're going to consume up both the fuel that we need to make NAD and also the NAD itself. And you have more systems than fighting for that. Things like senescent zombie cells or fat cells, cancer cells, those things also want energy just as much as your sirtuins or your PARPs are asking for it.
I love that you bring up the NMNT and CD38. Now, CD38 has come up, and so there are definitely ways to manage CD38, which we'll talk about in a minute. Is there also an issue with the salvage pathway? So there is, I mean, in the intelligence of the body and the intelligence of the cell, the cool thing about the body is it's not going to use a resource and then throw it away, particularly not when it comes to something as critical of NAD. So we have this recycling going on, but my understanding is that salvage pathway starts to be compromised in some way. Are you able to talk a little bit about what the stressors and all the stuff is doing, or are there specific things that are compromising that salvage pathway?
Yeah. So let me just quickly define. So the salvage pathway, it primarily functions on nicotinamide, and that's the thing. So it, like you said, our system doesn't really waste stuff. So NAD, an intracellular NAD, ultimately ends up back as nicotinamide, and that nicotinamide turns back into NAD. And so I'll talk briefly on the precursors. The precursors, the way they work is they actually are extracellular, and then they have to get converted down into NAD+, and then that recycles into nicotinamide, and that continues. So when you're looking at the salvage pathway, the two areas that you're worried about are that NAD out, that NAD plus molecule that gets put out, and then the nicotinamide molecule, which is sort of the fuel for that NAD plus. So NNMT, that enzyme that I just mentioned, it's actually degrading nicotinamide, and it loves to steal methyl groups, to take nicotinamide and steal methyl groups, and that converts into homocysteine. So you're actually creating this inflammation reaction from that side of it. CD38 is degrading, actually chewing up your NAD output. Right. So when I think of it, there's actually two buckets, nicotinamide and NAD, and these enzymes are consuming either the fuel for NAD or the NAD itself. And that, okay, inside of that salvage pathway, that becomes really important.
Okay. How are we all doing, guys? Are you hanging on? You need a paper and a pen for this episode. I should have said this at the beginning. I'll say it in the intro. So you mentioned precursors. Do you want to talk about the precursors you're referring to? I'm assuming you're talking about NR, NMN, and the big, there's more fur, feathers, and blood all over the walls about people screaming about which one's better.
Yes. So I'll start by saying, like, I think there's a time and a place for precursors. Specifically, though, what people lose sight of is that a lot of the input is not actually what's going into the cell, right? Oral NMN or oral NR is not going to turn directly into NAD inside the cell. So we're missing that usability piece. So when I look at it, you know, the difference between the two. So NMN can't officially enter the cells. It's broken down into NR, and then NR goes into the cell and is rebuilt as NMN, and that's converted to NAD. So you actually have this like multi-step process. So NMN has to go into NR before it turns into intracellular NMN.
So what's all the big deal with NMN? Like, why is everybody screaming about NMN being so important?
Because it's a precursor. I mean, I think.
But why not just take NR?
That would be my suggestion would actually just be to take nicotinamide. That's going to be your cheapest one. And that's the most vitamin.
That's just a B3. Is that B3 mm-hmm. vitamin?
Yeah. So it's the most available, and it's the most easily taken into the cell to turn into NAD. Whereas NR, you still have to convert it to get into NAD. That's why, like, truly this misconception of these precursors are not just fuel directly for NAD. They have to go through some steps in the process. And that's even like IV NAD is even more of that, right? You
have this. I was going to ask that because the NAD molecule is large, right? But we know it does not get into the cell as is. So what happens to that NAD when we get an NAD IV? It has to get broken down.
Right. The same way.
All the way down to nicotinamide, basically.
Exactly. So it's getting broken down all the way into the metabolites to then enter the cell and then turn into intracellular NAD. So the NAD you're taking from an infusion is not the NAD that's getting into the cell.
And so do you have any idea, any theories about what that NAD, like I've heard theories that what the NAD is doing is acting as an extracellular signaling molecule that's providing some degree of benefits, but it's not what people think it is.
Yeah, I think you do get this sort of flush of, you know, an NAD, a deep NAD replenish. And so yeah. The place that I say infusions make sense to me is when you're really trying to restore, right? You and I are both having a cold. If we get really sick, then maybe you need to restore NAD levels fully to kind of help. You're not going to get that same, you know, influx from a precursor that you would from a IV or like post a marathon, something that really depletes your energy system. But the thing that I think partly why the whole NAD infusion thing has gotten really talked about is people are like, I feel good. It's funny. I was literally just at a wedding on Saturday and the groom, who's my friend, he's like, comes up to me. He goes, oh my gosh, someone did this NAD infusion for me. I don't know what that is, but I feel great. And I'm like, like, do you know what that is?
Don't you find it fascinating how people will allow people to stick needles in their arm and dump a bunch of stuff without knowing what they're doing?
I know. So he's like, do you know what that is? I'm like, yeah, I do.
Actually, I do.
But people do get this like feel good. And I think honestly, a little bit of that is a fight or flight because you've thrown redox off. Right. And you're getting this kind of overwhelm of the system that your body turns a little bit into adrenaline, if anything.
Right, right. Well, you also feel pretty crummy when you're getting the NAD. If you're getting a high dose NAD infusion, you will feel bad. And there's nothing better for feeling good than feeling bad.
Right. Yeah.
Always it's contrast. It's like a form of contrast therapy, only different. But to that end, I mean, I'll do NAD infusions a couple of times a year as a replenishment. But in between, I'm a person who really believes in providing precursors, where there's a new trend right now, or I don't know how new it is, but there's a trend right now where people are doing daily subcutaneous NAD. And I feel that now we're starting to cross the line in potentially throwing that balance off.
Right. I think that's what people are missing, right? If I am not supporting the downstream cellular system, then if I just start putting new inputs into that system, I don't know what's going to happen. And that's where like these, if I have inflammation and I have all of these cells that are also energy hungry, I could potentially be fueling some of that senescence, in essence, because of all of this NAD I'm putting in. So to your point, there's replenishment because the world is hard and against us. But I know people who are doing NAD infusions, you know, every month, plus their sub-Q, plus their precursors. And now what have we done to redox?
And so what's the downside here? What can happen? And I feel like that this is where CD38 to some degree, but really NMNT come into the conversation. And this is the piece. You mentioned them earlier. I feel like this is the piece that a lot of people don't, either it's not on their radar or they're not fully grasping how important it is. Like, how did these enzymes shape our NAD metabolism, and why are they critical? And we're talking about energy, immunity, which are the core of healthy aging. So let's talk a little bit. What's the downside? Mm-hmm. And let's talk about this NMNT, because that's the one I think CD38 we get. It's an enzyme that gets upregulated. We need to suppress it. We can talk about how that works in a minute. But the NMNT conversation is different, and I'd love you to take us on that little journey.
Yes. Yeah. So it's much more involved than I think people understand, right? That's sort of the moral of the story. So when you throw all these precursors in, for example, now you've got all of this nicotinamide, because that's the salvage pathway is kicking nicotinamide, and it has to go somewhere. And so our body has a system and an enzyme to clear that excess nicotinamide called NNMT, nicotinamide and methyltransferase. And that M is important because that methyl piece means it's involved in methylation. And so you're actually, the way that we're clearing this excess nicotinamide is by using up methyl donors. So that's where the NNMT actually can steal a methyl group from SAMe, right? Your universal methyl donor, which is what you need for methylation for things like folate and B12 and choline or DNA repair, neurotransmitters, right? I mean, we know.
Right, super important, yeah.
The host of things that methylation is important for. So when I steal a methyl group, to help clear out this nicotinamide, then you're hurting your innate methylation processes. So someone who's a poor methylator already, right? Your COMT people, your MTHFR people, that's going to be extra important because they're already struggling with this. And now I've stolen methyl groups from this methyl donor. Wow. And then the other side of that cycle is it's then creating acetinosyl homocysteine. So now you've created homocysteine, which you need a little bit of, but as you've put too much homocysteine in, it's a direct inflammatory marker. And so you're actually feeding inflammation by not regulating this pathway correctly with NNMT.
And depleting methyl groups, to your point, a lot of people have impaired methylation and the last thing they need is to be depleting their methyl groups. So should people be supporting methylation at the same time as they're using these supplements? Like at some level, if you're taking an NAD supplement, do you need to be supporting, like providing methyl groups? And what would that look like to you?
Yes, I think that methylation story is an untold story of NAD. So if you're going to do NAD or infusions or precursors, making sure that you're supporting the methylation side as well. And then, you know, the supplement that I know of that works directly on this is called 1-MNA. And the reason 1-MNA is involved is because it's the body's self-regulating tool to blunt and block NNMT. So NNMT uprises, 1-MNA uprises, tones down NNMT. But we can't keep up with that naturally. So when we overstimulate NNMT, then having supplemental 1-MNA to help block NNMT, and then now you're supporting that methylation properly.
Right, because you're no longer depleting it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can actually block NNMT with 1-MNA, just like you can block CD38 with some of these polyphenols like apigenin and others that really sort of go in place of that, where that enzyme's trying to catalyze.
Interesting. Well, I know that when I do my, when I get my NAD IVs, we have methyl support. Methylation's like there's in the IV or in a separate IV bag, there's going to be methylation support.
Right. And that means they know a little bit more about what they're doing.
Oh, they know what they're doing. I figured out a long time ago. I kind of avoid the classic kind of run of the mill IV lounge and tend to go to people who have studied pathways and have a deep understanding of what they're doing.
Well, and it's interesting too, kind of on the same vein, right? Methylation and neurotransmitters. So when people do an IV, sometimes when they do say afterwards that they feel this euphoric, you know, sentiment, it's actually in part because you're slowing down the clearance, right? You're slowing down the methylation of those neurotransmitters. Because so now you've got these, you know, dopaminergic things in your brain for longer, then you're going to feel that way. So it's actually because of the methylation sometimes that you're getting that feeling.
And it's a temporary state of affairs. Like, let's be clear. So I think it's interesting what you mentioned about the NAD IVs, how really is as a pulse, it can help to, you know, as a once in a blue moon, like once in a while, in my case, it's twice a year pulse, you know, and I'm in my 60s. So I feel like at my stage of life, it's appropriate for me every once in a while to kind of overfill the bucket in a smart way to bring better balance to a system that might be falling out of balance. It's almost like my banking system is falling behind a little bit. So I'm repaying debt, if you will.
Yeah. And that's where like, I always, you know, the world is working against us. And every year you get older, the world is working against you more. And that is aging. Right. And so I think when you are older or you have some illness that's working against you in a higher fashion, you do need to replenish. You do need to give yourself additional support.
100%. So you've described, and you talked about it a little bit, but maybe go into it in a different way. So you described the NAD pathway really as an ecosystem, not a linear pathway. And I feel like people, the way we think is linear. We go, oh, it goes from this to this to this. And yet it's an ecosystem. So you want to, maybe I think we're going to end up talking again about CD38, 1NMT. So maybe let's repaint that picture for people so they get a really real clarity over all the circular processes here, just to kind of bring it back.
So I think one of the things, you know, to answer the question about ecosystem, one of the total misconceptions is people think of NAD as a molecule, right? Like they're like, NAD is a thing. It's a supplement. It's an infusion. It's a molecule. No, you're spot on. It's an ecosystem and a very complex one at that. And so we talked about the salvage pathway, but there's actually three pathways that you can get NAD from, right? And salvage, there's the de novo pathway, and then there's the Price-Handler pathway, and they all work differently and kind of take different inputs. And so you can get NAD from those first two, from outside, you know, what you ingest, and then from the salvage pathway, that's that recycling. And so all these metabolites have a certain role in these pathways. So the salvage, then you create the nicotinamide. Nicotinamide can turn into NAD. NAD plus then helps to catalyze electron transport. The sort of subset of that is the methylation pathway. So there's like a picture in my head where there's these two paths that come in, that's from the outside in. Then you have this little circle of salvage, that's the saving and the reusing. Then you have methylation, which is monitored in part by NAD. And then you have ATP over here on the far side, because that's the more linear part, right? Where you're jumping down through these complexes to create it. It's oversimplified, but...
But it's a good... I have the exact same picture in my head. The salvage pathway is a circle. The only other thing I have in my head is CD38 that kind of pops up, grabs, and steals.
Yeah. Yeah, look at my answers here. And then it's like,
which again is grossly oversimplified, guys, but it's, that's the...
Right, then you have like your sirtuins and your PARPs like fighting off your CD38.
Right. And sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not. But anyway, but I think that it's important to kind of repaint that picture so that people really get that there's more complexity here than just bringing an input in. I think, you know, like in a world where there's so much hype in the longevity space, there's so much contradictory information. And I don't even know that the research is contradictory. I just feel like people go in, grab what they think they want and really push that without always talking about the whole picture. And then in order to make it accessible to people, there's a tendency to oversimplify narratives. Like, how do you personally filter science from the noise? Like, how do you cut through that? And do you have any advice for people on that? Because I think that's where it's just so hard for people. I feel for them, you know, and frankly, I even can get caught in it sometimes. So what's your best suggestion for us?
Yeah, no, I mean, I talk, you know, I sit in a room with a lot of doctors with a lot of different opinions. And so it's always, how do you make sense of the chaos? I'll start first with the things that people are starting to understand better, which is, you know, look at who funded the study. That's always like, if there is a specific study that you're trying to discern, and just because a group funded it with a, you know, incentive, I don't think that completely says the study is hogwash, but just take it with a certain lens at that point. Right. And then similarly, like some of the study design things, but that starts to get a little complicated.
Yeah.
I think this is where GPT and AI has a really powerful role. Right. I tell my AI when I act like an unbiased cellular medicine scientist, don't tell me anything that's a lie, don't extrapolate. And like, then if you give it all of these directions to be as unbiased as possible, it can help you make sense of that. Right. Don't tell me things I want to hear. Tell me what's the actual backed in peer reviewed scientific literature.
And so it's amazing that you have to create those prompts, but it is more amazing that you can put in those prompts and then get the quality information you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But you have to be, that's where like, if I just put in AI and say, tell me if this is legitimate, I don't even trust that, right? Because AI has got its own biases. So I think that's a place. And then the other thing that I've started to, goes back to what I said at the very beginning, fundamental cellular biology hasn't really changed, right? And we have a lot of data about, like, how does electron transport work? And how does this enzyme do this thing? And so when you start to understand the cell mechanisms at place, now you can intuitively ask yourself, does this make sense? Right? Yeah. Like, that's why I like the NAD conversation, because it's, okay, now that I start to see that there's this balance and NAD and NADH, and they're both important, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait, then maybe it doesn't make sense to put a whole bunch of something into a system that requires balance.
If you've accepted bloat cravings and that post-meal crash after eating is your new normal, I'm challenging you to feel better. And I'm giving you the cheat code, the Just Thrive Gut Essentials Bundle. It pairs two clinically proven superstars, Just Thrive Probiotic and Digestive Bitters. Just Thrive Probiotic is the only probiotic clinically proven to arrive 100% alive in your gut for a difference you'll actually feel. We're talking less bloat, better energy, and even clearer skin. Then there's Digestive Bitters. It packs 12 science-backed herbs in one tasteless capsule that jumpstarts your digestion and supports GLP-1 production, so cravings don't control you. Imagine that, signaling your own endogenous GLP-1 production. Together, they'll transform the health of your gut so you can feel like your best self fast. There's even a 100% money-back guarantee, so you have literally got nothing to lose. For over a decade, Just Thrive has been helping thousands of people take control of their health with science-backed solutions you can trust. From their award-winning probiotic to their full line of gut, immune, and brain health supplements, Just Thrive is ready to help you live your healthiest life. Take the Just Thrive Feel Better Challenge today and save 20% off your first Gut Essentials bundle. Visit justthrivehealth.com/nat20 and save 20% with promo code NAT20. See the difference for yourself or get a full product refund. No questions asked. That's justthrivehealth.com/nat20, code NAT20. When did mRNA break through for you? When did it hit your radar? Yeah. Because, you know, it's a whole new player here. A lot of people don't know about it. It's still pretty fringe. We don't see it in too many places. Like, I really found out about it from you last June when we ran into each other at that one conference. So what first made you kind of sit up and go, oh, this is interesting?
Yeah, no, I great question. So I think because of the clinic that I was at and the conversations I was being a part of, we were talking about redox, right? Like, redox has become second nature in my vernacular. And you can't talk about redox without talking about NAD and NADH. And then we were at a conference where we heard the lecture mention 1-MNA as part of this NNMT NAD system. And really in this light of, like, it could be a molecule that helps us block NNMT and support NAD. And that had never really crossed, you know, through to the full language of NAD metabolism yet. So when we started to go look for it, that's when we found that it wasn't available in the States anywhere.
Right.
And so followed the research. Well, first we looked at the research and you're like, wow, actually there's quite a bit of research on 1-MNA going back decades. And why has no one heard about this? And then you follow it to Europe and you find some of the original research out of this group in Eastern Europe and starting to look into that. And so it really was this very organic, like, we wanted it for our patients. We followed the science, we followed the research. We couldn't, you know, and we had to work through some confusion, like there always is. And then we connected with the group out of Europe to really help bring it to the States. And that's where, you know, that's inside of our business hat. That's why we started this separate company, because we want to keep the clinic and the business separate in a lot of ways. The clinic is for clinical and research and patients, and we don't want it to be tied to a bunch of, you know, financial incentives. So I really am on the business incubation side. I'll consult the clinic on operations, but that's mainly it at this point.
Yeah. Well, and so going back to 1-MNA, it just seems to solve a problem that
we didn't have a solution for before in many ways. And so there's emerging research on it and its roles in inflammation, vascular health, metabolic resilience. So what's an insight from that literature that hasn't yet entered the mainstream conversations, do you think?
So if you look at the earliest research on 1-MNA, a lot of it's actually tied to endothelial function and like microvascular function. And it's not totally clear. I think it still sort of is related to NAD, but when you actually dig, there's a lot of unrelated to NAD effects of 1-MNA. And this signaling of nitric oxide is part of that. And so,
I didn't think we were going to nitric oxide today. Okay, let's go.
So I actually can see through a lot of the literature, this endothelial enhancement. So when you start talking about how do you improve fatigue, it's not just because of NAD, but you're also improving microvasculature. And it gets kind of deep into like COX pathway and nitric oxide signaling and yada, yada. And I can't honestly speak at the level of those pathways as I can on the others, but think that's something that we take for granted as well, is it's not just an NAD boosting molecule. It has these other completely unrelated effects in the system as well.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is I think that in the human body, I don't think anybody gets to have one job.
Exactly.
Like if you look at any molecule in the body, it never has only one job. It's like there's never one pathway to get to an end. There's redundancies, there's other pathways, there's backups, there's things we don't even know about. And so to that end, I think that 1-MNA starting to elucidate some of the other purposes and uses and reasons why it's important is really, it makes more sense.
Right.
Exactly. In many ways.
And then
do we make it?
Do we make it? Does our body make it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does our body make it? Like we make a certain amount of 1-MNA at this point. What we're doing is we're supplementing. And do we need to supplement 1-MNA because of the NAD supplementation, or is it also a molecule that gets depleted or is becoming more challenged, or maybe there's more demands on it as we age?
Yeah.
So maybe that's what we should talk about. There's more demands on a molecule as we age instead of it being depleted.
I think in general, the narrative needs to go that way, right? Like that's really what's happening. Depletion is that more things are demanding its time. Well, so yes, question one, and 1-MNA is naturally produced by the body inside of that NNMT cycle. It's like the counterbalance to NNMT. So when NNMT goes up, 1-MNA goes up to block NNMT, NNMT goes down, 1-MNA goes down. It's when that can't keep up, right? There's a lot of also rate regulation inside of our cells. You can only do things so fast.
Right.
And so that's where we can't keep up with the amount of NNMT. And so what we need is to supplement with 1-MNA to support that system.
Interesting.
And so then the 1-MNA, I mean, originally it was discovered because it was just a urine biomarker. Like it was a proxy that we were looking at to understand B vitamins and other things. And then we realized it actually had all of these implicit benefits. And that's when we started to go down the research pathway of it. And then COVID actually also, there was some studies that came out with 1-MNA supporting long COVID. And a lot of that had to do again with the microvasculature, right? And how the actual vascular system can be improved post COVID.
Huh. Wow. Okay. I think my cold is taking up too much space in my brain for really.
I know this is a hard question today.
In case the audience hasn't heard the sniffling in the background here, the two of us are fighting through, probably we might actually benefit from an NAD infusion, the two of us, right?
Yeah.
with a high dose of MNA.
Just to simplify it, because I know it's like, and I talk and dive deep and then you come high. Overall, I think NAD is a system to pay more attention to balance NNMT and CD38, 1-MNA supports imbalancing NNMT, epigenin and others support imbalancing CD38. Those naturally restore NAD, and we can then occasionally pour more into the top of the bucket when we've blocked the things at the bottom.
I love it. I love it. And so, my takeaway from our conversation so far is also, if I'm going to be using NAD precursors and any NAD, really, one MNA has to be part of the equation. Like, they're just, it should be like peanut butter and jelly. Like, what MNA needs to be part of that formula to really help to maintain some balance in the NMNT 1-MNA.
Yep, exactly. That's kind of the story that I want to bring awareness to, is if you're going to support your NAD system with precursors or with infusions, make sure that you are also supporting the downstream metabolites by blocking the bad guys. And you can do that through 1-MNA. And then there's others on the other side.
You know, from a quantity perspective, it seems to me like you don't need buckets of 1-MNA here. Like, it was interesting to me when I looked at the dosages. I was like, wow, you know, you would almost think, whoa, I'm going to need grams of this. And it's actually not the case. Although, you know, if we look at the dosage on the bottle and where we might want to go at certain times, and maybe you want to talk about that a little bit. Like, are there certain, without being prescriptive, you know, neither of us is a doctor, but without being prescriptive, are there certain instances where people might need more MNA than they think? Would that show up in some ways in them that they might notice?
Yeah, I think so. The bottle single capsule is 58 milligrams. And that dose came out of some of the studies did show improvement in fatigue at 58 milligrams as sort of the baseline dose. As we've started to use this more and we've gotten feedback from our practitioners and from patients, definitely need more when you're sicker. I mean, there's safety testing done up to 6 grams, but I think more in that 200, 250 milligram pulsed when you are at a deficit is going to, that's when we see people talk about the benefits more. And those are going to be like the anecdotal things that we hear a lot are obviously fatigue, brain fog, anything that kind of is just indicative of mitochondrial dysfunction. But other interesting ones that I've gotten is anywhere that you have a lot of mitochondria. For example, the eyes, we've gotten a couple of people to tell us it's improved eyesight or it's helped with cataracts because of the amount of mitochondria in the retinas. I got a question, and this research hasn't been done. I'm just hypothesizing, but I got a question about fertility and also in menopause, right? Where your ovaries are also hugely mitochondria dense. So helping restore mitochondria function, you can see improvements there as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting when that research happens, right? I think that if you, as you're talking about this, the brain, the heart, the ovaries, in men, the testes, kidneys, like for chronic kidney disease, these are all organs that are so critical and so dense in mitochondria. It'll be so interesting to see over time as the research develops.
Yep. Yeah. We're early days and starting to, I think we got really a lot of research on NAD broadly because people started to realize it's important. And just now we're starting to find the next layer of research in all the balancing that's having to happen.
I love it. Now, if someone wants to know whether their NAD is low, what are the realistic or appropriate ways to assess that? And does knowing truly matter yet?
Yeah, I like this question because I think, you know, I get this all the time. Well, how can I measure it? How can I measure it? There are some groups that are starting to take a more intelligent approach to measuring NAD and NADH ratios. And they say they can get them intracellularly. And I think we'll start to learn more. Right now, a lot of it is at the research level. Even again, this is a research level test, but you can measure the cyclic ADP ribose, which is a measurement of consumption of CD38. So like you can start to get these interesting proxies, but for the layperson, that's not super helpful right now. So the measurements that the biomarkers that you can get in general labs that are proxies to help us understand your NAD levels are going to be those ones tied to inflammation and tied to mitochondria function. So the easy ones, right, like highly sensitive CRP, homocysteine is a good one because we just talked about with that methylation.
just to slow down, if your homocysteine is high, then there's a possibility that supporting an AD would be helpful in bringing that down.
Exactly. Yep. Nailed it. Yeah. Because if you have high homocysteine, you likely have upregulation of NMT, which is consuming your NAD faster.
There you go. Okay.
So that would be a way to say, okay, you probably need to supplement with something to support your NAD.
And your 1-MNA to balance your 1-MNT. Yeah.
That's where, like, on the 1-MNA specifically, we see improvements in homocysteine because of that direct blockage, right? That's where it's really the most, like, directly influenced. But then because of the CD38 side of it and some of these other enzymes, just general inflammation markers, that's where things like CRP would come in.
Okay, so you're measuring other markers to identify a depletion of NAD. There's no actual, do you think that, is there an NAD test out there? Is there anybody saying they can measure NAD? We don't have to name names, but what do you think of those tests?
I mean, there are people who are saying they can measure it. A lot of the ones that previously I've looked at are just like looking at serum levels of NAD, which I think that's kind of, they're looking at serum levels of NAD plus, because NAD plus is the more stable molecule, easier to measure.
Right.
There is a group that I've started talking more and more with. They were actually at the conferences that we were just at. That's a European group they're the first group I've talked to that's like, we understand it. We think all of this, you know, NAD hype is not representative of the full story. And we're looking at NAD plus ratio with NADH intracellularly. And
wow.
That's what they say.
So we'll have to see.
It's currently available in like Germany, and they're actively talking to a couple labs here in the States to see if they can get those labs to run the assays. So watching it closely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and you know, so the interesting, again, the takeaway, NAD, NADH are in constant flux with each other. So,
right.
Exactly. I mean, what would be really interesting in a case like that is to do in real-time studies to see that ratio while you're getting an infusion.
Yeah. And
you know what I mean? Like, don't you think that would be so interesting? Because that would really give you insight in terms of how is the cell able to manage that dump,
right,
if you will.
Yeah, what happens, right? Like, yeah, that's honestly would be, if we can get this NAD and NADH test, even if we can't get real-time, it'd be cool to do it right before an infusion and like minutes after an infusion and then an hour after, just to start to understand.
Just to see how's the body managing this. Yeah. How's the cell able to manage? I think that would be so interesting. Okay. Let's step away from supplements for a minute and let's talk about what are the highest ROI? Go to the entrepreneur brain. What's the highest return on investment, low cost and free strategies for either preserving or recycling NAD naturally without relying only on supplements? What should people be doing to support those NAD levels?
Yeah, I think I love talking about supplements. I know like that's our world, but as someone who, you know, works and sells supplements, I still always say that sleep and exercise are the most potent drugs you can take. So I'll talk about why specifically for NAD, even though it's a little bit like, yeah, obviously sleep and exercise. So sleep, what's really interesting when you start to go into like where sleep comes into this story is you have this enzyme. We didn't even talk about this one, but it's called NAMPT, NAMPT. And
okay, well, we can talk about it now. We have a few minutes. Let's do it.
But that's one of their main NAD recycling enzymes. So it's what's helping in that salvage pathway. And it's actually a clock-controlled enzyme. So it has, you know, circadian understanding. And so when you sleep, that enzyme is more regulated because you have better circadian functioning. So you're actually, when you, you know, are sleeping dysregulated, your salvage of NAD is also dysregulated, which is kind of interesting.
That is very interesting. That is one of the few concrete statements on depletion of cellular pathways related to sleep that I've ever heard anybody say on this podcast. Everybody talks about sleep. It's so important, blah, blah, blah. But very rarely has someone said, okay, your NAMPT, which is the salvage pathway enzyme, if you're not sleeping, it is not going to be able to do its job. So you're not really going to be able to salvage your NAD, which means you're going to wake up in the morning. And part of the reason why you're so dead tired is you just never got to replenish your NAD, to recycle it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And that kind of extends then into exercise too, because another thing that regulates this NAMPT is resistance and anaerobic training, right? So like those stress signals are helping, because a lot of it also has to get into like some, you know, the mild stressors, right? And why hormetic stress is so good. And that's part of this whole story that kind of weaves throughout all of it. But that's the same idea with exercise. You're regulating the salvage of your NAD more efficiently.
Huh.
And so those two things together, you can actually probably do 99% of what all of these supplements are supposed to do.
But I feel with exercise, it bears noting that when you tip over to the opposite side, when you're overtraining, essentially what you're doing now is you're overtaxing a system that can't, it just can't solve it. It just can't replenish your NAD. It can't keep up.
100%. Yep. That's
okay. And what are the signs of that?
What are signs of that? I mean, I think it's a great call out. Just like we can throw this whole redox system out of balance with taking too much of one of these precursors or NAD. Exercise is the same thing, right? You're putting a redox stressor on the system. And when you create too many reactive oxygen species with not enough time to recover in between, which is what hard, ongoing, strenuous exercise is doing, you're actively creating mild reactive oxygen species, but then they become severe. So what that will do is exactly the same thing. It'll throw your redox balance off and your mitochondria won't be able to keep up. And so you've kind of taxed the mitochondria versus made them more resilient. And that's that a little bit, but not too much of a good thing. You want resiliency. You don't want fatigue.
Yeah. Well, you know, my poor husband, I'm going to throw him under the bus now. He does these, he's a swimmer. And on Saturday mornings, they have this workout that is insane. And you can find him Saturday afternoon comatose on the couch. Like the man literally can't function. And I'm sitting there going, okay, we need to give you some stuff. We've overtaxed the system. It literally can't cope anymore.
Yep. Yeah, that's why like our cells, they want stress, and then too much of it or not enough of it is going to put you into a bad place.
So basically it's lifestyle.
It's lifestyle. Yeah.
But do you think lifestyle's enough as we're aging? Like for me, right? I'm now becoming poster child, right? I'm just turned 62. I'm like, for me, I don't know, is sleep and exercise going to be enough, like managing my stress, my circadian rhythm, which just got shot to heck going across time zones. Like, is it going to be enough? Or I do feel that we get to an age where like you can maybe get away with all the lifestyle stuff in your 20s and your 30s to a point. But once we've tipped over to the other side, is it possible that we now need these supplements to a degree to keep us, to hedge everything back into our favor?
Yeah, I think it's how I look at it is like there's the sort of three core pillars of sleep, exercise, and diet, which we can talk a little bit about diet in that too.
Yeah.
But just like we started this conversation with like we're in a post-toxic or post-COVID world, we're in a much more toxic world. Like it used probably, and this is totally speculative, maybe 80, 100 years ago, it didn't matter that you were 62. You could do all the lifestyle things and that would work. But we're just up against so much more stressors in our current environment that are trying to age us faster. So I do think you have to supplement. You're not going to get everything right. My caveat to that is you also can like cycle your supplements, right? You don't have to do everything all the time, 100%. Because that's a little bit of that stress on our system too, right? Sometimes your body has it, sometimes it doesn't. So you need that variation because that's what builds resiliency. So yes, I do think you have to have some supplementation as you get deeper into the world to stay healthy.
Yeah, I agree. I did an experiment. I'm not sure when this podcast will come out, but I did an experiment this summer. It was kind of inadvertent, but I kind of rebelled against myself and basically stopped taking 90% of my supplements.
What happened?
I ran a metabolomics test in September, and the doctor that I went through my results with, and it'll come out in a podcast, he was like, holy crap, Nat, your NAD's in the toilet, your glutathione's depleted, like you need to get back on the train. Which of course, by the time I recorded the podcast with him, I'd already come back on my stuff anyway. But it was really interesting to me that it actually did show up in this test. So this conversation around, we don't need supplements, we can get everything we need from good lifestyle and food, it takes you so far. I think to your point, the world is different. I also think our expectations as we age have changed, mm-hmm. right? A person in their 60s, one or two generations ago, had very different expectations of how they were going to function and operate in the world. So I'm not sitting here saying everybody needs to be on a $500 a month stack, but I am saying that there are some foundational, and this here we're talking about foundational nutrients to support cell repair. And going back to something you said, I think at the very beginning of the podcast, and that is that if we can support the cell in producing energy the way that it needs to do it by either removing things or adding a few smart elements back in, it will take care of a lot of things downstream. And so there's other supplements you may not need that are just trying to band-aid a fundamental lack in cellular energy.
Yep, exactly. That's really, and like, the whole, how do you discern what's legit, what's not legit? Those are the questions I ask myself. At what level in the system is this working? Is it working at a top level, middle, or the root level? And that helps you decide what to prioritize.
What's one longevity idea or technology that you believe deserves more attention from the mainstream than it currently gets?
We talked about NAD, so I'll sort of leave that as one of my main ones. I think I've also, and I don't know if this is a good place to segue into it, but I've gotten really fascinated with ketones as well. Yeah. And I think it's a similar rationale because I've learned more about electron transport and how energy systems are, you know, how this whole ATP as our currency and NAD as the transaction system converting all of these different inputs to ATP, right? And ketones is one of those. So I have gotten much more into that science and research. And I think ketones have been really talked about in the performance space for a long time.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're getting talked about quite enough in the longevity space. Maybe in the keto diet way, but not what high dose, being in ketosis for a, you know, high dose ketones can really do for cellular health.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've both been sipping on our, this episode was fueled by ketones. I don't want to go too deep in the ketones only because we're running out of time, but I do think it bears mentioning there's ketone salts, ketone esters, different types of ketones out there. You have one that, quite apart from working really well, and we'll talk about why it works well, it actually tastes good, which is a shocker in and of itself, because ketones have historically been one of those things where either you're getting this ketone salt, which, you know, it has some good to it, but it doesn't offer the full package, or you had to block your nose and swallow something that just tastes like jet fuel, pretty much. I think with Kinetic, you've solved that problem. But very quickly, let's give people a list of the benefits of ketones that go beyond performance, because I think it has to do with the inflammatory pathways and energy systems as well.
You need, so NADH is one of the inputs for electron transport. FADH is another one. Ketones actually help skip a step of NADH converting into ATP. So they're kind of coming in a step later and supporting FADH into ATP. And why that's really important is because it's giving your mitochondria some relief. Your mitochondria are actually not having to work quite as hard to make ATP. So when you hear this idea of like ketones are more efficient, it's because they're actually helping your mitochondria to not have to like go through every single step of the process to make ATP. And in doing so, you're letting your mitochondria recover a little bit, or maybe for proper mitophagy to occur. And so now you've created a more efficient system. And then that leads into more of the inflammation benefits and other things like that, kind of secondarily. But I'll point out why, again, the cell is so smart. And if we give it the right tools and the right fuel, it can self-correct. And ketones are a way to do that as well.
You bring up an interesting point in that this is for someone who's not necessarily in ketosis.
Exactly.
Right? And we're in a world where people are lacking the metabolic flexibility to ever get into ketosis. And this would be a natural fuel that the body would have access to on a regular basis if we were metabolically flexible, if we didn't eat every chance we got. In a way, I feel like it's bringing back a molecule, access to a molecule that our bodies need, would have historically had access to.
100%. Exactly. I mean, metabolic flexibility is, by definition, your body's ability to be flexible in what fuel source it's using to fuel metabolism. And we used to have to starve occasionally, and we had ketones to be on board to do that. And now it's hard to get people into a ketotic diet, even myself, or, you know, people who are healthy and oriented that way. So why exogenous ketones are nice is because having any ketones on board is going to be helpful in improving metabolic flexibility. You don't have to be, you know, above a 1 millimolar or above a 1.5 right, or whatever ratio that we're saying. Having some of that fuel source is going to be useful, and you don't have to be in a ketotic diet state to do it.
Okay. And last question on the ketones is, what is the difference between this ketone molecule and some of the other ones you'll find out on the market?
So I think the biggest thing to look at when you're looking at the ketones on the market is whether they have the actual BHB, like beta hydroxybutyrate, which is the ketone body, or if they just have what's called 1,3-butanediol, which is the precursor. So a lot of things claim themselves to be ketones, but they're actually just 1,3-butanediol, which is just telling your liver and to make its own ketones. So ketone esters are one of each molecule bound by an ester bond. So that's where that originally started from. What we figured out with our partners is how to make those two molecules free floating. So you're getting BHB and 1,3-butanediol. They don't have the ester bond, but the ester bond is often what causes the bad taste and some of the other challenges.
This tastes great. Yeah. I'm going to put it out there. This tastes really good. All right. Let's get back to this. So when you look, let's go back to NAD science for a minute. And so when you look ahead 5 to 10 years, what do you think is coming in the world of NAD science that people aren't anticipating yet? Like, what's Courtney seeing down the road here?
I think the biggest one is we're going to be like, why were we all doing NAD IVs all the time? I mean, we're starting to see it. Like, there's little studies popping up here and there causing you to ask the question of, hey, maybe this is doing some harm. And I think 10 years from now, we're going to be able to look back and say, oh, we actually did see that NAD, high doses of NAD for certain populations caused increased, you know, risk of X, or was bad for people with Y. And just in general, like, maybe we're going to find out that NAD infusions were not the most effective compared to other things at replenishing our NAD. So that's my overall take. I think we're going to look back and be like, wow, one of the lectures that I hear is about radium. I'm sure you've maybe heard this lecture before. It's like how it gets started. No, this is a quick side note, but it makes sense. We used to use radium.
With the people glowing in the dark.
It was this elixir, right? And it actually, a little bit of radium, when you look at like radiation therapies and things like that, is good. But you actually, then we started to say, oh, we need radium for everything. And we put radium in our water and we put radium in our clothing. And then we found out that it's actually not a good thing.
It's really bad. Yeah, people would be glowing thinking they were really doing well.
Exactly.
And they were developing horrible cancers. So which brings me to the next one. So the next question, which is really, you know, it used to be biohacking, now it's longevity. Like, this is an industry where excitement often outpaces actual evidence.
Yeah.
So how do you balance innovation with scientific rigor, because that excitement is part of innovation, yeah, right? So how do you balance the innovation and the scientific rigor?
It is the challenge. And I think what we have to continually ask ourselves is, how are we pushing forward with the science we already know, right? And are we working against that, or are we building upon that? And so I'm not cowboy enough to, you know, want to just really do something that I have no idea what's happening. I appreciate those people. I think that they do draw the science forward in both good and bad ways. So to balance it, I tend to lean on, how do you do intelligent innovation or intentional innovation? We do have a lot of information. AI is giving us even more access to information. Let's look at the foundations that we know and build upon it, not ignore it. And I think sometimes we ignore what we already know.
Yeah, I think that's great. I also think what you said earlier about AI, it's going to be about using AI intelligently and asking it to create the right filters for the answers that we're asking for. Because I think AI overall in our industry is going to be a good thing. It's going to allow us to connect dots that we didn't even know existed. But it's buyer beware. Like, you got to be asking the right questions and pushing it to create the filters that we need to put in to avoid with something that's all hype without substance.
Yeah. Yeah. I encourage everyone. I mean, there's some of like the baked in, you know, you can tell your AI to answer every question in a certain way. Like, go add that into your baseline for your AI. Always, you know, call out caveats or tell me when you're extrapolating. And then at least you're aware to make your own decisions.
Love it. All right. When you imagine your future self decades from now, what impact do you hope your work in longevity will have had?
You're asking all sorts of deep questions now.
I know. Well, that's what people want. I mean, people are like, M&A, blah, 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 blah. But what's Courtney hoping to make? What's your impact going to be? Or you hope?
Yeah, I love it. I truly have always kind of seen my role as helping to bring the science to reality. And that's probably a facet of sitting in these hats between, you know, doctor and businessman.
And
also sort of an innate mediation mindset. But what I would hope 10 years from now is that I brought people into a little bit more understanding so that they can make more educated decisions for themselves. Like, if you don't agree with what I have to say, that's great. At least hopefully you're asking more questions. And that's everything I try to bring into the world, is just to help educate people to ask better questions to improve their own health.
Love it. All right. What's one belief you hold about aging or metabolic health today that you suspect may evolve or be completely overturned in the future? Is there something we're holding right now that you think, I don't think we quite have it right yet, and we're going to need some time to figure it out?
It's starting, but one of the things that I think is inverting barely to start that I hope will continue to change is we're both biohackers, but I think we're moving less into biohacking and more into sustainable lifestyle. That's community, right? You're seeing the studies come out about what it means to have good friends. We're losing community in a lot of ways. That's having whole meals that we cook ourselves. I think going a little bit back to the basics, without losing the innovations that have been helpful, but that's what I hope we will look back and say, hey, you know, we got a ton of biohacking and innovation to raise awareness. Now let's go integrate that into what we've known for thousands of years.
I think that's a bit of a, I think it's happening, honestly.
I think too.
People are really starting to happen. And part of that is people saying nervous system regulation. Well, how do you regulate your nervous system? A gadget might help, but being around other people, hugging a dog, hugging a loved one, like basic co-regulation, like these are the things that really land. All right. Last question. If you could offer your younger self, who would have been 10, I guess, one insight about ambition, entrepreneurship, and navigating complex scientific fields, what would it be?
I think the biggest thing is having the confidence to give your opinion, but then have it be broken. I think that's a lot of, you know, as you grow up in this world, especially with a lot of big opinions being yelled at you from every direction. I mean, you sit in the middle of it. You talk to people on your podcast who have big opinions. And I think it's really easy to, like me, even 5 years ago when I really got back into this industry, I was a lot more timid and like, I don't have a big opinion yet. What can I proclaim out here in this industry with everybody else yelling about something? And I think it's okay to say, I don't know. And here's what I'm learning, or to say, this is what I do know. And to really like, stand behind that. But then 5 years from now, maybe research will break that. So it's a little bit of like the balance of confidence and humility. That is just a hard, hard thing as you're around all these different people that are really smart with big ideas.
Love it. I like that. The balance between confidence and humility is, I think a lot of people in the world could use a bit more of that. All right, Ms. Courtney von Busen, where can people find you, learn more? We will have a link in the show notes, folks. And in that, from that link, you can get your hands on the 1MNA and the ketone product we're talking about. There'll be a discount code in there. The link is onerous to say the least, so I can't read it out. The code will be NAT10. But in the meantime, Courtney, where can people find you and basically follow your learning journey? How can we follow along here?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can follow me on Instagram at cvanbuss, V-A-N-B-U-S-S, or add me on LinkedIn. And then the company that I helped spin out and run is called Longevity Launch Labs. And that is longevitylaunch.com. And that's where some of our business, the different businesses that you can kind of navigate to from there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for today. I feel like the two of us really battled through this one. Both of us.
I know, hopefully our cold on top of NAD systems is a little bit of a challenge. So.
Yeah, I'm going to go take some more precursors and MNA and pound my ketones for the rest of the day.
But hopefully we got enough of the core info out for everybody.
I think we did. You did a great job. So thank you so much, Courtney. And it's been a pleasure. And we will talk again soon, I'm sure.
Well, thank you for having me, Nat, and I hope you feel better.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.